Welcome, everyone. We're thrilled to have you join us. I'm Diane Finkhausen, a CEO of Shoshimworks, and I want to welcome everyone to this very special Ecosystemic Futures session on in-space manufacturing. This unique event this afternoon, and as I mentioned, marks the launch of Season 7 for Ecosystemic Futures, and it also celebrates America's 250th. And with Season 7, we are going to be leaning into the strength of systems, how we field America's next 250 years. I see that we have executives, investors, researchers, and policy leaders from across the country and around the world, actually. And that's exactly the cross-functional perspective we hope to connect with this exciting conversation. We are blessed to have Lynn Harper and Dan Raske join us today. Lynn and Dan are longstanding friends of this program. And for those of you that haven't yet had the opportunity to catch the podcasts or the webinars that we have shared with Lynn and Dan in the past, just a quick background, and then I'll ask Lynn and Dan to provide a little bit more detail. But Lynn Harper is a pioneering leader in commercial and scientific space initiatives. She co-founded and led NASA Space Portal and serves as strategic integration advisor for the ISS National Lab and is co-founder of NASA's In-Space Production Applications, or INSPA, portfolio. And she's overseen 10 INSPA projects on the ISS and has contributed to the 100 plus NASA payloads, including missions to Mars, a comet, and deep space. Dan Raske is an internationally recognized expert in reentry systems and thermal protection materials, with over 35 years at NASA and 5 years with the US Air Force. He co-invented, Dan, you have to keep me honest on the pronunciation here, phenolic impregnated carbon ablator, the PICA, in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. Excellent. I practiced that one. Let's see. And I co-founded the NASA Space Portal and instrumental in programs such as COTS that launched SpaceX's success and initiatives like INSPA for microgravity manufacturing. So you can imagine the wealth of experience and perspective we have in store for us in the talk today. And with that, I'm pressing pause and handing over the mic to Lynn and Dan. Lynn and Dan, please share a little bit more about your background and let's dive in.
So Dan, why don't you start?
Okay. I'm recently retired from NASA. I retired on December 31st of this year. Yay, after 37 years of very interesting career at NASA. I've had a chance to work on many flight vehicles. Actually, was at the National Air and Space Museum just this last week and had a chance to show my partner five of the missions that I had significant input on that are on display at the National Air and Space Museum. So I was real pleased about that, including the Stardust capsule, which is there and has the world's record for the fastest entry ever at Earth. And that was using this PICA heat shield that you mentioned, Diane, and that Elon Musk chose for his Dragon spacecraft. During my last, about 2005, so during my last 10 years, roughly 20 years, excuse me, 20 years at NASA, I had the fortunate opportunity of meeting and working with Lynn and several other colleagues, Bruce Pittman, Mark Newfield, and really working to open the door for commercial space. And one really big success story we had was SpaceX. And we don't have time to get into all those details, but we were instrumental in the stand-up of SpaceX, as it turns out. And the second thing that we were very instrumental on was the International Space Station, both it continuing to be on orbit. There was actually some significant discussion back in the 2005-2006 timeframe about deorbiting the ISS, and we did some things that actually changed that decision to continue to support it. And then Lynn led the charge more recently, starting about, I think about 5 years ago, on opened the door of doing demonstrations and experiments on the space station that have application to quality of life and on Earth and markets on Earth. And that's one of the things we're going to be going through. Len's going to be going through a number of examples of that. So I've been very pleased, you know, where things are at, and very pleased to leave, moving to retirement at this great moment in time where it looks like the door is opening for substantial benefit, direct benefit to the U.S. public from space development. Len's going to get into that. One of the biggest challenges we have right now, which we'll touch on, is right now we're essentially at the demonstration, laboratory, and prototyping phase of a lot of these developments that Len will talk about. And we still need to get to scale, both scale in quantity, scale in the industrialization and throughput, both up and down from space, to make these innovations and demonstrations available to the general public. But it's a very exciting time. And then with that, let me turn it over to Len. Len.
Thanks, Dan. So it was really interesting to see the topic and the overall theme that you have in your webinar series, because I think Dan and I would both agree that we have never done a single thing of significance alone. It's always been as part of an ecosystem and in the collaboration with other just truly exceptional people that we've been privileged to work with. So I'm going to start this out by saying the reason that we're here today is because Dan Rasky invented Pika. And because we could bring home, and because SpaceX adopted Pika and used it, we could start bringing home payloads from space at a rate that we had never seen before. The result of that was to accelerate learning faster than we've ever seen it done in the entire history of the space program in terms of the microgravity area. And the result of that, I started my first space shuttle experiment in 1978 with the Boy Scouts of America, and I've been working on LEO and deep space investigations ever since. I have over 100 investigations that I've been instrumental in, and we're still working on them now. One of the things I think is remarkable is that between March of 2022 and today, I've supported 70 live flight operations on the ISS from my bedroom, because space is now that accessible. My daughter, in supporting a company called SpaceBuilt, queried and statused her payload, which was halfway to the moon, from her bedroom at UConn, where she's a student, using her cell phone, because space is now that accessible. So the combination of the ability to access space easily, conveniently, you don't need to drive anywhere, you can do it through your cell phone, is a huge game changer. The result over the past 20 years happened in 2024. So I've been working on these payloads for 40 years. In 2024, we all saw something that we had never seen before. And that's what I'd like to share with you today. So what we're going to talk about are exceptional results reported by U.S. innovators on the International Space Station between 2022 and 2024. And it's like nothing we had ever seen. And before I start, though, all of these are in testing and in the final development before they can go either into a product or into medical care. But one of them made it all the way through, and we'll talk about what that means. So we want to set the stage that says, for in-space manufacturing for terrestrial markets, your product that was manufactured in space not only needs to be better than anything that's ever been done on Earth, it needs to be so much better that you can pay for the ride, pay for the development, make a profit, and still be able to serve a market and to serve a market in a reliable and acceptable way. If it's medicine, it's got to pass the FDA different approval requirements. And the FDA has been terrific in working with us on this. So we'll start there. This all began in 2014 when Dan Rasky and I asked Alex McDonald that we would like to find out where gravity was impeding U.S. industry. We brought in our colleague, Ioana Cosmuda, and Bruce Pittman, Mark Newfield. And among us, we interviewed more than 500 CEOs and CTOs of various high-tech companies and found out there were a lot of areas where people wanted more bandwidth, faster processors, greater energy efficiency, more processing power in smaller volumes, better performance in more extreme environments, better pharmaceuticals, atomic and molecular level precision. And there was no end to that demand in sight. And it was already in 2014 pushing materials and products to the point that defects at the atomic and molecular level mattered. And this is where we knew microgravity could help. So we were able to persuade the ISS office to invest. And 10 years later, when we looked at it again in 2024, we took nothing off the list and added semiconductors, quantum, regenerative medicine, and medical devices. We're standing on the shoulders of basic research from both the biological and physical sciences in NASA and STMD, and also the ISS National Lab. The ISS National Lab supported one investigation done by Merck, the pharmaceutical giant, that paid for the entirety of their program and more besides, and a significant fraction of the ISS as well. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Right now, they are getting more funding from external sources than they are from NASA, and they have leveraged their little $15 million program into applications that are important to us all. So that inspired us to take it to the next level, which was INSPA. And Dan Rasky was instrumental in this because he's a material scientist whose materials have flown and have been a game changer in enabling the return on commercial vehicles of astronauts, people, cargo, and especially very delicate cargo that enable new classes of work. So in-space production applications is focused on doing things in space that will have applications and markets on Earth. We serve U.S. interests by developing materials and technologies that strengthen U.S. leadership, as well as national security, and create high-quality jobs. We provide benefits to humanity by developing products that significantly improve the quality of life for people on Earth and accelerate development of the space economy in LEO by stimulating demand. Most of what we pay attention to in space development is on the supply side, but these are the people that want to use it. And then what the approach that we did was to invest in national genius and to increase the national proficiency in in-space manufacturing. And that turned out to be really exciting. Now, we have a rule in INSPA, and it's the Carl Sagan rule. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So we're going to just talk about a few of the results over the past couple of years that have been, that have delivered extraordinary claims, and they have provided extraordinary evidence supporting them. In we go for independent validation by third parties who are not us. They are other government agencies usually, and these are the ones that have passed. To lay it in context, if you're not familiar with technology readiness level, what this chart does is it lays out from the point of discovery on the left-hand side, where the risks are very high, to a proven product on the right-hand side that's been proven multiple times in the environment. And at each of the stages, there are different funders and investors. And in the early stages, TRL 1 to 4, so a discovery to its first prototype application on the lab bench, is primarily government. And then almost no one, government or anyone else, funds through the technology valley of death. It's one of the hardest places to get funding, but that is what makes the difference between a great idea and a great product that people can use. And then finally, at the end, it's production process and scale up, which can be every bit as challenging as all of the initial work. So what we're seeing is this is the innovation pipeline, and all applications stand on the shoulders of basic research, and the government's necessary to enable breakthroughs that before profitability becomes obvious. I'm going to give you the short summary, and then I want to pause for Dan to give his views of this as a material scientist. What we saw in 2024 was nothing short of shocking. We found that microgravity had significantly improved results in high-value materials and products at all of the levels of the organization of matter, from subatomic all the way through people. And that the materials that they were looking at were potentially wealth-generating, life-saving, life-enhancing, and important for national defense and U.S. leadership and our ability to compete and win in industries of the future. So, Dan, could you talk about it? You were the chair for the intrinsic merit reviews from which most of these came back in early 2022.
Yeah, let me just say that I think this is really a profound time. And essentially what's happening now that we can have much better access to space than we ever have before, we are in effect opening a new innovation and discovery frontier. And if you look through history, whenever humans have been able to access a new fundamental environment, we've learned incredible things and developed new products. And a very good analogy is back to the 1700s and 1800s when humans could make a vacuum and start looking at things you could do with a vacuum. And it's somewhat of a comical history that people working with vacuum back in that time were ridiculed because what could you do with nothing? Because vacuum essentially was nothing. And it turns out, working with vacuum led to the whole electronics industry because it's the first time we saw free electron transport when they were trying to keep carbon filament light bulbs from plating carbon on the bulbs. And Edison put a electrode into the light bulb and found out there was a current to the electrode, and which led to vacuum tubes and then onto electronics. And then also working with vacuum led to the whole freezing and cooling and controlling of atmospheres for food production and for, you know, AC in our homes. And so that was a new area that humans ventured into, which had tremendous impact. And now we're looking at really venturing in a big way into this new microgravity environment. And Lynn's going to give some specific examples of how surprising a lot of the results are from microgravity, things that you would never expect to have impact from a microgravity environment, which do. And so I think this is a very important time for the U.S. to develop these capabilities because, as we've seen in the past, whoever ventures into a frontier benefits from it. And so I'm hoping we continue to venture into this microgravity frontier and in a expansive way so that we can reap the benefits for the U.S., of course, but also for humanity. And so I think this is a really important time. And Lynn, yeah, we'll be going through specific examples showing where the microgravity effects are having a profound impact on a lot of important processes and observations, and I think eventual products. Go ahead, Lynn.
Thanks. So I'm only going to highlight a few of them just to give you a flavor. And we would be glad to follow up with people who want to dive deeper later. So INSPA focuses primarily on this grouping, from crystals to medical devices based on thin films to alloys, photonics, and composites, and cells and tissues. And while we had seen the promise in all of these areas for the past 50 years, they were so spread out in time that it wasn't until 2024 and we saw them all together that we went, oh my gosh, we've never seen anything like this at this quantity. So the first product from space is the knowledge product. Let me just show you one knowledge product from space. This is Merck. They flew their leading cancer drug, Keytruda, and they found that if you take a look at the top row, that's the way the Keytruda crystals were growing on Earth. And they'd been in the lab for 10 years. They were looking for a way of controlling the uniformity of crystals so that it could become injectable. And after 10 years in the lab, They flew 30 days on the ISS and they saw the bottom line and it was uniform and it was the right size. And they had never seen this crystal form before in all of the time they had been looking. They were generous enough to publish their results in Nature Microgravity in December 2019. And the story got better because in 2024, that new inspired subcutaneous injectable form of pembrolizumab, I practice this a couple times a day, pembrolizumab, they were able to pass FDA's phase 3 clinical trials. And the good news on this is because you can inject this rather than have to be administered through an IV, it saves about $50,000 per patient and an estimated $20 billion a year savings, as well as generating about that same amount in revenue from this new product. So at $20 billion a year, estimated by 2030, they are now exceeding what SpaceX is making as a company from space. So this is swapping it around the demand side. And this is where we want to go to maybe make the first point. There are two ways of improving affordability for space endeavors. The first one is to reduce the cost of a payload pound by a factor of 10. And that's what all of the companies are going for right now. And that SpaceX has largely succeeded in doing. The second thing, though, is to go the other way and improve the value of the payload by 100 times, 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times, or be able to do something you could not do at Earth at any price. And that's where we are in demand. So this is just another example of how good this gets. The story got better. Redwire, on the left-hand side, we've been growing insulin crystals on Earth for 100 years. It's one of the first pharmaceutical products. And they look like the left-hand side, which is kind of junky and small and disorganized. The right-hand side was just the flight test of the hardware from space. They picked insulin because it would inform a large community, and everybody was surprised to see the quality. The third-party validator said they were the prettiest insulin crystals she had ever seen in her career. The story got better because 500 crystals were studied by Butler University that had been grown in space since 1973, and more than 80% of them improve in structure, uniformity, and size. And most of them improve a lot. And you have to realize these were first flights. For the most part, this was the first time the hardware flew, first time the crystallographers ever tried this. There were some that were multiple, but most of them were first flights. It didn't matter whether the crystal was as simple as table salt or as phenomenally complex as the monoclonal antibody that Merck uses for Keytruda. And in that group are 160 semiconductor crystals, and they have at least 90% improvement in these areas. So complexity, temperature grown, type of crystal did not matter as much to the quality as just doing this in microgravity. Story got better. Not only was microgravity through crystallization, but they were also improving composites. And so this was a composite flown by United Semiconductor that was so good that on Earth, they got a 5% yield from their product, which they do sell and have a customer base for. In space, they got something like a 90% yield. And just by that, that would have been exciting news, except it got better. The microstructures got better in space. They were, and in fact, they got so much better that if they had gotten 5% of that improved structure, they would have called it a win. So now what they're looking at is a significantly improved product and a significantly improved yield of that product. And these were independently validated by NIST, which is the platinum standard. There are different places where space can play an enabling role in semiconductors. We can talk about that. It's its own topic, really, and it would be good to bring some people in who have studied this extensively. But there's at least three areas. One, of course, is in the development of new things that cannot be done on Earth. Another one is just better materials beyond silicon that take advantage of the processing capabilities in microgravity to get superior yields of superior product, and then the manufacturing into wafers and other devices. There are certain areas where microgravity helps, certain areas where it'd be better to do it on Earth. So now you see there's a map in the background. And one of the reasons is we're just curious to see where all of this talent is coming from. When in, let me just say, on January 1st, 2024, if you had asked me whether or not we could do commercial quantities of any consumer product on Earth, I would have said no. By March, the answer was yes. Flawless Photonics, in an absolutely remarkable tour de force performance with full control of the in-space manufacturing process, produced more than 11 kilometers, more than 7 miles of Z-Blan optical fiber, hair-thin Z-Blan optical fiber in microgravity. In an apples-to-apples comparison, flight to ground in the same unit, the space results were at least 5 times better than the ground results under the same condition. This was independently validated by another group who did Z-Blan processing in space and saw the same thing. They had reported it actually ahead of Flawless. So this just shows you, you know, Z-Blan was first discovered in 1975, and in 2024, we went to commercial lengths in space. This was done over 16 days, and it got all the way through that TRL pipeline. Now, for people like me who have vision impairment problems, I have macular degeneration. And one of the things that microgravity does is allows better thin film production in a way that will enable Lambda Vision to produce superior quality products, which they are now in the process of developing for clinical trials on Earth. Their goal was to hit 50 layers in space. They are up to 200 layers in space, and their results have been extensively scrutinized by a number of ophthalmologists and eye surgeons and others who are looking to see whether or not this new product can replace the not-so-good options that we all have. This one is probably the last one I'm going to talk about before pausing again, but I have read a lot of post-flight reports over my 40 years in NASA. None of them made me cry, but this one did. So what this did, a group is called Encapsulate. They're from Connecticut. And what they did was they took cells from colon cancer patients. And back in 2016, 6 patients. And they flew them in space and they did all of the standard omics. If you know what that is, it's genomics, proteomics, metabolomics, biomarkers. And these are standard package tests that all of the researchers that we're talking about do. But this group did one thing that nobody did. Nobody had ever done. They had measured how far the cells moved from their point of insertion through the space interval. And to understand why this could work, you have to know that space is deeply, profoundly, importantly still. And because it's so still, because nothing is operating on the cells, they saw that the cells from 2 patients didn't move much. And the cells from 4 patients moved a lot. When they did the double-blind study post-flight, what they found was the cells from patients that did not move, where the cells did not move in flight, did not die of metastatic colon cancer. But in all 4 cases of the cells that migrated a distance in space, all four died of metastatic colon cancer. When we showed this to NIH, they said, get us 100 samples. And I am very pleased to say that the International Space Station Program Office has supported that. And then I do want to say before we go any further, especially when we're talking about a project like this, to give full marks to my colleague, Kevin Engelbert at the Johnson Space Center, who is the portfolio manager for INSPA and absolutely a first-class leader and manager that has been instrumental in the development of this field. The support we've gotten from ISS has been absolutely enabling. So this gets us to where we could talk about the rest of the country, maybe pause and open for questions. when I did this, because I have eye impairments, I did a gray on gray and just did the states where our companies are from that have delivered exceptional results from space. And what we saw, it was like the lights going on across the country of areas of extreme excellence in space manufacturing. And that's where we are today. This is the floor. I have no doubt whatsoever that we're going to get much, much better with practice. And so I'm going to skip this. We can talk about INSPA particulars later, but today's space does offer a new way of manufacturing that supports industries of the future in many, many different areas. And it can open new jobs and new industries like remote manufacturing. If you can manufacture controlling it from Earth to space, you can manufacture controlling it from Wisconsin to Florida. In other words, we can remove the geographical limitations for people being able to do manufacturing personally for high precision and unique components. One of the things that we believe that needs to happen is we're going to need to increase national skills in this area. And through the space grant colleges, through the university and so forth, we need to increase our technological game in space capabilities and space development. So with that, let me pause. Let me just see if there's anything. Yeah, that's probably the last message. So Dan, you want to take it from here?
Well, I think maybe we can open it up for some questions. I thought that was a pretty good summary, Lynn. Let me just reiterate that, I think this is a very important development that we're seeing right now. I think people will look back 50 years, 100 years, and see what an amazing time this was. This new frontier was opening, and that I think will profoundly impact the quality of life for people on Earth, and products, and new jobs, and new opportunities for development. And we're pleased that we continue to see support from the NASA side to have the capabilities in place to expand ISS and its access, hopefully with SpaceX and some of the other commercial space providers, have more ways of getting to space, have more operational capabilities in space, and be able to bring, of course, products and information back. And so that needs to continue. And I think with our new administrator, finally, we can hopefully look forward to that. But why don't we open it up for questions that people may have and see what we can answer.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Lynn and Dan, thank you so much. Just amazing results. And I'll kick it off with a quick question. And then folks in the audience, if you can use the little raised hand emoji, we'll get to everybody's questions in sequence and hopefully have a great dialogue here. But Lynn and Dan, you've shown us so much of what is now possible, which was previously inconceivable, really. And it just really it challenges the imagination regarding the economies, the potential breakthroughs that are now possible, and even kind of beyond what we can imagine here. But looking beyond these current examples and demonstrations, what do you envision the next frontier is? What becomes possible when we do have persistent commercial LEO infrastructure with power, volume, and regular access?
So one of the biggest things is that the quality of the microgravity product can be so significant that it's a disruptive technology. So it's an opportunity for the U.S. to leapfrog over what is currently being done in a progressive manner and go to next generation industries. I do believe that semiconductors and quantum materials will be fabricated eventually in space, because in order to get the precision and the quality that they're looking for, microgravity definitely offers an edge. The real surprise is in the medical sciences. We have a group that is currently working and doing extremely well and working on nerve regeneration. They're working on cures for blindness that you just saw from Lambda Vision. They're working on the ability to deliver better therapeutics directly into tumors and other hard to reach areas like cartilage for osteoarthritis and things like this. We're definitely going to see those. But the other thing is that space seems to accelerate disease maturation. And we've, among us, discussed this considerably, and we think that's the right way to say it, that more than several different top level world-class researchers reported that they were seeing accelerations of years in a month in microgravity, and that it allowed them to investigate different parts of the disease that were invisible on Earth. That's a big deal, because if we can improve diagnostics, such as what you saw for the metastasis for cancer, if you can determine that right away, doctors will change their diagnoses for these. But a better cell and tissue culture also allows you to find the cause of a disease by years to decades faster, saving millions to billions of dollars and lives, as well as testing the various cures so that you're using the cells from the patients, from ourselves, our unique physiology, to determine if that unique medicine will work against your unique condition, and we'll be able to investigate some of these much more. It is not a replacement for terrestrial research and development. It's the other half. If you saw the movie Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark, the way that you can think about what space is offering is, if you recall, the Nazi burned his hand on the amulet, and it burned a template in the location of where the ark was. And so they went off and they're digging there, and they were digging in the wrong place because the amulet had two sides. And the other side had information that was critical to know where the real location was. And that's, I think, what we have for the two pieces in space. We have the ground piece, the space gives us the other side, and that gives us an advantage in addressing a lot of these diseases. So I'm seeing it in material, semiconductor, quantum, and definitely in regenerative medicine, medical areas.
Yeah, let me just add to that, Lynn, that from the material side, we're seeing improvements, as you mentioned, in crystals, uniformity, and with fewer defects than we thought were possible. And even some phenomena, which we call in some quarters annealing of single crystal materials that seem to heal in microgravity that we don't see at 1G, which is quite, mysterious, but we have evidence that that's happening. And so the ability to have materials and other products that aren't even possible in on the ground, I think, is really exciting. And on top of that, I wanted to mention one area that seems to be getting a lot of attention that could have significant impact on even energy prices and a certain amount of climate change, is certain well-funded people are looking at putting server farms in space, including Eric Schmidt of Google fame. And it turns out one of the fastest growing areas for energy consumption is running AI models. Okay, we've seen now, we're getting inundated now with AI apps and applications. And well, what's running all those AI models? Typically, it's large server farms. And we're finding it more and more difficult to position server farms in areas where you have adequate power, and where you're not despoiling ecosystems, because one of the waste products of a server farm is heat. And so how do you, dispense with all that heat and not destroy various fragile ecosystems? So one thought is that you put server farms in space where you can have essentially 24/7 power from the sun, and then radiate the heat to deep space where there's no ecosystems to disturbed. And several people I know, also Elon Musk and others, are looking at this as well, and I believe Jeff Bezos. And so we may see a near-term product from space as far as advanced data systems, but as these, and that I think could be very, very helpful, not just on Earth, but also in providing the incentive and resources to improve our transportation systems to space and back, which I think are going to be really critical as we develop more and more labs and capabilities in space to pursue these various product lines. in areas of development that can have so much impact on opportunity and, you know, the human condition on Earth.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah, we need to push the infrastructure up there and get the routines in place and help the investor and innovator communities understand the magnitude of this potential. So the work that you're doing is so important and brilliant, and we appreciate you leading the way. Go ahead, Dan.
Let me just add one thing to that, because you're exactly right. I think this is quite, you know, important. The challenge is to get more people to understand what the opportunity is, because what we find, and I know Lynn has information on this too, is that how few people actually understand this opportunity. It's actually a very, very small group. And hopefully it's improved by how many people we have online here. 35. Hopefully the number has grown by 35. But it's amazing how many intelligent, informed people have no idea of any of this. That we're, as Lynn used to say, it's one of the best kept secrets around. It's this phenomenal opportunity in space. And it's hard to communicate in many cases to business leaders and investors, okay, what is the opportunity here? And, you know, how real is this? And things of that sort. And I guess the concern I have is that this is not, we're not in this game alone. There are other people, including Chinese and others, who would very much like to get into this, get into these arena. In fact, in the last, I'd say, 20 years, the Chinese have made more progress in this area, particularly with regard to materials and crystals, than the U.S. We actually dialed down our activities in some of the in-space activities over the last 20 years, and we're hoping to change that trend and dial it up and see an extension and expansion of the International Space Station to continue to perform this work.
Couldn't agree more. Could not agree more. And with America's 250th, I am optimistic that we will see an intensification of the focus on growth, economic prosperity, and advancement of innovation. And I know our audience is doing the hard work as well. Hopefully, an audience would just ask that you help carry this message to your networks. I see we have quite a few questions lining up here in the chat window. So I'm just going to call folks out by the sequence of the questions offered. And folks, if you wouldn't mind, when I call on you, if you can come off mic and maybe open up your camera, if you're comfortable, ask your question, and then we'll move on to the next. But the first question is from Yufan Lee, and hopefully I've pronounced that correctly, from Lockheed Martin Space. Great question in the chat window. Yufan, if you wouldn't mind coming off mic or coming on mic and asking your question for Lynn and Dan.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thanks. And sorry for not turning on my camera. But I'm very intrigued in this idea of remote manufacturing in space, where, you know, people can access the manufacturing space in microgravity from terrestrial locations. I'm curious about your perspectives on what are the major roadblocks, whether it's technical, policy, or otherwise, that's stopping us from getting from here in 2026 to that future state. And I'm also curious about, do you have any estimates on how many years it might take us to get to that place where I can actually access an in-space experiment, a materials experiment from my phone?
So you can do that last one now. You can do that using the space station. So that's a really great question. In terms of, let's just start with, where can people access microgravity space and what are the biggest barriers? Flight frequency. So flight frequency is probably the biggest showstopper at the moment. And with that is cost. Everything that you manufacture in space, you need to be able to sell at a profit on Earth. And there's just a certain cap for what certain things are worth. And there's a number of different steps for the flight frequency that over the years has actually prevented this field from developing as rapidly as it honestly deserved to develop, just because we would see one result in 1 year and the next result 5 years later. It was that slow. But with the station up 24/7, 365, with flights going back and forth to the station 4 to 6 times a year, you've got a perfect storm for that. Now, when the space station goes away, the commercial community is going to need to step up, not just for the 4 to 6 flights per year, but the equivalent of that 24/7, 365. In certain areas like semiconductors and quantum, where you are going for super precision and super quality, you're probably better off in an uncrewed manufacturing vehicle optimized for that purpose, rather than, let's say, a multi-use vehicle like the space station, where the space station and where future commercial space station will shine is in the first flights and the development of new capabilities. Once you know where the manufacturing sweet spot is in space, you're going to want to dial it in and automate it and not have anyone touch it or go near it. And then another thing that's oddly effective is that the transit between LEO and the moon may provide orders of magnitude better gravity environments for even higher precision, as well as super high vacuum. So we don't really think about Artemis from the perspective of in-space manufacturing, but it may actually be a node. So the biggest thing right now is the companies are ready to go. They're very small. The biggest one I talked about was the Zeeblan optical fiber, and that would fit in a tall kitchen garbage can. So it's easy to move these into other vehicles, provided they provide the infrastructure like power, communications, data, protection from launch and landing stresses, and so forth. But thank you for that question. It's a key one.
Yeah, let me just add on to that real quickly. One of the biggest bottleneck right now is actually on-orbit facilities, capabilities, and transportation to and from. And this is something that Lynn and I and Kevin Engelbert, we have been trying to promote more government investing in this areas, and then coupled with commercial investments like we're seeing from SpaceX and Blue Origin. But it's still, I would say, lagging considerably behind the opportunity that we are seeing. And I think, you know, with time, we're going to see, you know, more investments both on the government side and the industry side made to put the infrastructure in place to support these activities. But it's not there right now. And we actually have a considerable bottleneck at present, both as far as accommodations on the ISS and transportation to and from the ISS. Correct, Lynn? Isn't that still the case?
Yes, we're hoping we're going to get relief from that this year, but over the past couple of years, it's been really tight. So there is one more thing that's really important. InSpa invested in the innovators, and we need to do more of that because these are not the only products. These were the first and the easiest. When we ran out of money before, we ran out of excellent proposals in InSpa, and it hurt not to select them. They were that good. And then from what we've seen from the results, there's at least another dozen that are every bit as good of what I just talked about, but they're harder to explain and they're still in further development. So this is a big field.
Yeah, I would agree and add to it just for our audience's benefit as well. A collaborator of the InSpa team on the DOW side is the SpaceWorks team, some of whom have joined us this afternoon as well. They also are investing in some of the entrepreneurs in this space and have just launched a new program through the Bridge Partnership, an opportunity, basically a marketplace for rideshare opportunities. Mm. So for small businesses, for entrepreneurs who are looking to push basically payloads up or run some experiments in orbit, that is potentially an option to explore as well. I want to be mindful of the line that we have for questions and try to get to as many folks as we can. Lynn and Dan, I don't know if you can stay with us for just a few minutes more, but we have three more questions in the chat window here. The next is from Shannon Fedenko. Shannon, if you wouldn't mind, there we go. If you can take yourself off mute, great.
Yes. Hi, everyone. I'm Shannon, CEO of a startup company in Florida, Aloft Biotechnologies. We're trying to develop a bioreactor for cells in microgravity. So this has been phenomenal. Thank you. I was hoping to ask you for your perspectives of the current state of funding. You know, when you think about your low TRL level companies and your chart of who funds where. There's an emphasis on governmental funding on the low tier all companies. But, you know, in light of the reauthorization status and where SBIRs are, I was just wondering if you can share with us your perspectives on what you think funding, governmental funding looks like for U.S. companies right now.
So
where the opportunities are, I guess, is the question.
So there should be SBIRs coming out soon as Congress reauthorizes the SBIR program. I don't know what the status is of that, but I do know that all of the SBIR programs are looking at what the next generation challenges are that will, you know, support the national needs, what the country needs, both in health as well as in commercial and industrial leadership, as well as national defense. I do think we've worked a lot with the other government agencies. So I think the doors will continue to open for space endeavors. And we're going to work together to try to support those happening. One of the things we didn't talk about for INSPA that made INSPA work is we did a brutal peer review. It was tough. But once you got in, we helped you succeed. Okay, we brought in SMEs. We tried to make sure that you didn't make the same mistakes that people have been making for 50 years. You don't need to make it too, you know, so we can avoid that happening and so forth, things like that. I think the door is going to open more because the results are just that good. These are all, you know, the results that I'm talking about are in the public domain, and many of them have publications. We're adding to those publications. 2024 was a blockbuster. 2025 was better, and 2026 is better than that so far. So it has been terrifically exciting. We don't see this going away. Having said that, we've talked with all of the different agencies, NSF, NIST, NIH. They're all looking at how we might be able to do more in their particular areas using microgravity environment. I don't know how that's all going to shake out because, as you know, everything is in kind of in flux right now. But I do believe that there will be more funding and more opportunities.
Well, and INSPIRE, which is the primary program that Lynn's working under right now, it's hoping to see its funding expanded as well. So in-space production applications. And so there's links to their website and when solicitations come out on that behalf.
And when SBIR opens, INSPA will have a topic in it. And we hope to have more than one, but we'll have at least one.
Okay. Thank you both very much.
Excellent. Thank you. And next on to Nathaniel. Nathaniel Miller.
Yeah, good to see you guys. So just some background, I've built a small, I think I have a 27 spacecraft up before I went and did a bunch of companies. And I got a few materials companies up that are out in the wild now. And then my last job was manufacturing business development at NASA Langley, and I'm retired. So I am no longer NASA, which is really weird. With that background, the question is, it's really weird, guys. It's really weird. So I've got to make a business now. I'm making a business now, really just organizing and testing. And so I think a lot of the people on the call would be interested in understanding what are the signals, the commercialization signals that are not getting through. Lynn, I loved your comment about how still space is. And that was, you put it on the bio front. And then Dan, it was not lost to the astute observer that crystallization also matters and the still environment really matters. So also the radiological environment, et cetera. It's a gold mine. Like, what are the signals that commercialization is missing?
Okay, so here's one that we need to solve. There's a concern about scalability. As I was mentioning, a lot of these activities are either laboratory or prototype scale. They aren't industrial scale. And so if you're talking to investors, they're looking, okay, well, how do I get to industrial scale? And that is a nut that still really hasn't been cracked. And that's where Elon Musk with Starship and some of these new options for orbit access, I think, are going to be really important to show that you can get to scale. Right now, the biggest successes have really been, as Lynn was mentioning, knowledge products. So in other words, going up and doing an activity and finding a new way to create a product that you can emulate on the ground, which is what Merck did. Merck actually found a new form for their protein and found on the ground, once they realized that that form existed, that they could play with it on the ground and get it manufactured on the ground. So I think on-orbit scalability has been one of the things that has really hampered this. And then also two other areas, let Lynn weigh in, upfront cost, because this is not a cheap activity typically. And then also the learning curve, as Lynn mentioned. Okay, so many things in space are counterintuitive compared to what people are used to on the ground. So you have a long learning curve to get to, okay, something you want to do in space, being able to afford to do it in space and have it successful. So that kind of that learning curve up to a successful product has been part of the signal as well. Lynn?
Yeah. And I think the other thing is we just knew about this in 2024. So if you think about it, 2024 was a pretty busy year in the United States, and so is 2025. So I think most people just don't know. They do not know about how much better these materials can be in space. And then there's the overall thing that we're looking at processing in space for terrestrial markets, which means we're trying to take the best of what we can do on Earth with the best we can do on space. And that gives you something truly exceptional. Most of the people don't know about it, and you need to support people who are first flyers. So that's another, it's a subtlety, but it's an important one. The biggest one is just how accessible space is, how much control you have, and how much better it is. That's the one we need to get the word out on, and which is why we presented this for decision makers, not just decision makers at national scales, but decision makers who are making local investments in technologies or businesses that are at the cutting edge of high tech, and they need performance that they just can't get on Earth. Space is a real option now.
Solid points, all. Thank you.
And Diane, thank you. Diane, I'm sorry, but I got to drop now. I actually have another meeting, as it turns out, lined up on this. So thank you very much. And hopefully Lynn can stay on for a little bit longer if there's more questions.
Sure.
But thank you so much.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We do just have one final question from our very own Marco Annunziata, Lynn. So you'll remember Marco from our previous events. And Marco, over to you.
Thank you, Dan. Lynn, first of all, thanks to you and Dan. This was fantastic. Really an eye-opening presentation in many respects, and I would have a million questions, but I want to just ask you this one thing. Let's focus again on the issue of scale, because you've made the point at the beginning, space is now very accessible. I can access it from my phone in my bedroom, but we just heard about the challenge of scaling. So in your dream world, what would you like to see over the next, say, 5-10 years to accelerate the process of making space even more accessible? So all these innovations, both the trial of new innovation and then the production, can scale. What's the best case scenario, and who needs to do what?
So that's a great question, and it's a central question to making in-space manufacturing a success. So it is the flight frequency, and by that I mean not just the launches, but accessibility to the in-space conditions that you need for optimum manufacturing. That may be on a crewed vehicle, that may be on a free flyer vehicle. It's always application specific. So for example, semiconductors, they run at 900 degrees C to 2500 degrees C. Biologicals run about 37 degrees C, you know, so, and they work well within a crewed vehicle. So just the sheer number of opportunities. And again, you need to invest in the teams, because this is all about, this takes a village. This takes smart people in technology, hardware builders, the best in the scientists. If you're doing stem cell work, by the way, stem cells do great in space. If you're doing the stem cell work, you need to bring the best stem cell people in so that they are informing each other about what the qualities are of the manufacturing tools in space that you need to bring in order to get that exceptional quality. And you do need exceptional quality. The other thing is you have to bring them home with exceptional quality, which means protecting them from temperatures that can melt metal, you know, as you go through the atmosphere, and then slam your delicate samples down with their high precision into the ocean. So you better be protecting them. And then you have to get it from wherever it landed to the customer. That whole end-to-end pipeline needs to be filled, and it needs to be routine, accessible, and as cheap as possible. And as soon as you get below a certain point, and I don't know where that point is, but certainly $1,000 a kilo is a game changer. for all of these at $1,000. Kilo, these are very small in-space manufacturing products. As I said, the biggest one is about the size of a kitchen garbage can. The rest of them easily fit in this bottle. And so if you need 100, you fly 100 bottles. You need 1,000, you fly 1,000 bottles. That's not the most efficient. You're going to take up more room. It's going to be more mass. It's going to probably take more power than something if you add a batch or a larger culture, but you can do it that way. And that can get the scale up. I think we need to demonstrate all of those over the next 5 years to 100 samples. We need to get up to lots of 100, because from 100 will get you 1,000. So right now we're in the tens. We need to go to the hundreds. Hundreds gets you 1,000. 1,000 gets you as many as you want. You know, you've proven it, and then you're paying for it.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you. Good to see you, Marco.
Likewise.
Excellent. Excellent. And Lynn, thank you for hanging in there a few more minutes with us. Clearly, we have a million questions for you and would love to continue, but want to be respectful of your and the team's calendars. So we will wrap things up there, and we may see if we can coerce you to come back and visit us again with more of your amazing results. But Lynn, thank you so much. And you and Dan, the work that you're leading is so important. And we will do our part to help get the word out. And I know many of the folks in our audience are doing their part to help lead innovation in these arenas. So we'll probably be bringing some of their stories to this venue as well. But we appreciate you, Lynn, your team, your community, and your ecosystem. And for the folks on the call here with us today, please help carry this message to your networks. A couple of tech takeaways from my notes today. The physics are real. These results are validated, not projected. The pathways exist. NASA INSPA proves that ecosystem orchestration with intention can help really drive breakthrough innovation through the valley of death. The strategic stakes are very high. Nations, as Dan and Lynn mentioned, nations that master space-enabled manufacturing gain advantage in industries that will define 21st century leadership. And as many of you have asked, this recording will be available. We'll post this recording to shoshimworks.com before the end of the week, and we'll drop a note. So check your email, and we'll have additional resources there. If this kind of insight and dialogue resonates with you, please do subscribe to our Ecosystemic Futures podcast. With this conversation today, this launches season 7. We host space pioneers, defense reformers, deep tech entrepreneurs, all of whom are sharing how ecosystemic thinking delivers capabilities that achieves peace through strength. That's our theme for 2026. And please do stay connected with us. Again, I'm Diane Finkhausen. I'm very available on LinkedIn, and all of our content we push through LinkedIn. So would love to have you share your thoughts in LinkedIn regarding the session today. And please do, if you enjoy this kind of content, subscribe to our podcast series. Really, very different futures are available to those who can thrive beyond Earth versus those who remain constrained by the terrestrial applications. So think big or go home. Again, everyone, thank you again for joining us today. We loved having you with us. And Lynn, thank you for the amazing work that you're leading.
Thank you for this wonderful opportunity. And also a shout out to Lambert Land out there. I just saw that he's in the audience. It's a kind of collaboration in SpaceWorks and with DOD and NASA that is really being very productive. We want to see more of this, and I'm your tax dollar at work. So let me know, you know, if there's something we can do. Thank you so much. It was a privilege.
Absolutely. All right. Have a good afternoon, everyone.